Hi, everybody, and welcome to Chart Attack. I'm Dave Lifton, and this is a new thing that we're going to be doing here at Popdos. Well, it's not really new. We've done a few Chart Attack podcasts in the past, but now we're going to try to do one every month and with a rotating cast from the Popdos staff. Let me give a little bit of history here. When I first approached Jeff Giles about bringing my old Wings for Wheels podcast over to Popdos in the summer of 2008, I wanted to use the whole Popdos staff. Well, that never happened, and some other members of our staff have started their own excellent shows. But last year, Chris Holmes came up with the idea of turning Chart Attack into a regular show, and that got the ball rolling here. But for this debut episode, we've got two people whose voices should be familiar to all of you who have been listening to the podcast that Popdos has put out. Our editor-in-chief, Jeff Giles, and the founder of our sister site, Poplerd, Mike Heiliger. Gentlemen.
Gentlemen. Where are the gentlemen?
In my pants.
Oh God.
I've heard about there being gentlemen in your pants, Dave.
I take what I can get. Beggars can't be choosers.
This is not a proud podcast.
This is a... They never are. They never are.
Why don't you tell our listeners what we're in for tonight?
Okay, well, Dave. I will. But before we start, we should give a word of thanks to our good friend Jason Hare, who started Chart Attack on his own blog years before Popdos started. He's unable to contribute, but he gave us his blessing to use the name Chart Attack for this podcast, and we hope that we will do justice to his creation.
Unable.
Yeah, the nerve from having like a job and a kid.
Kid, what the fuck? Okay.
Fatherhood ruined him.
So, for those of you who don't know what Chart Attack is, we pick a Billboard Top 10 list from a random year of the week that this is going to be going live, and we talk about all the songs. So, for this first installment, we've got the top 10 songs of the week for February 15th, 1986. So, let's start with the number 10 song.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
And it's Conga by Miami Sound Machine.
Featuring?
Well, at this time, it was only Miami Sound Machine. It was
Is
not
that right?
Gloria Estefan. Yeah.
It was just Miami Sound Machine.
This was their first mainstream chart hit.
The album cover was just her big fucking face, wasn't it? I assume that...
All of her album covers are just her big fucking face.
Yeah. You know what? Here's a brief aside. I love the cover to Cuts Both Ways because that is some of the smartest graphic design of the 80s. The way that they position the camera just so and drop that little curl just so. And
is that the black and white shot?
Yeah, it is the black and white, and they applied that that acid wash rinse to the print so it looks like she has no nose. It's the nicest picture of Gloria Estefan that's ever been taken.
Oh, and the curl comes right in over the
exactly,
thing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. The cover to this record, this was Primitive Love, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much.
It is just the picture of like her almost disembodied head.
Yeah, just staring at you. With the mom mullet that she had at the time.
Is that a mom mullet or is that like a Latin fro?
I think it's a mom
mullet. Is there a difference?
Okay, I'm not quite sure what a mom mullet is.
Look at the photo.
It looks like a fro.
Here's what I thought of when I listened to Conga 10 times this week, you motherfucker.
Oh, God.
This was kind of the last wave of successful female singers who could kind of be your mom.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely.
There was her, there was Aretha, there was Carly Simon, there was Linda Ronstadt, there was Bette Midler. All classy ladies in their 30s and 40s wearing the high-waisted jeans.
I feel like Gloria Estefan was a couple of years younger.
Yeah, because this was her start, so.
I think she was 29 when Primitive Love came out.
Okay.
But again, let me direct your attention to the photo on that album cover. See if you can imagine just putting that head onto an administrative assistant.
Yeah. I can.
But you know what I mean? The I guess Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears are kind of edging into that demographic sort of a little bit these days, but
not the way they started. I mean, but then again, Linda Ronstadt didn't really start that way either.
Right. And neither did
Carly Simon. Yeah.
I'm curious to see what those two will do.
Maybe it was just that in the 80s you were looking for a maternal role model.
Well, I was 12 when these songs were popular, but it's just interesting to me. It's also true for male performers. I mean, you also had guys like Rod Stewart and Mick Jagger and Aaron Neville or whoever. Those guys were scoring hits too, but I think there's been a kind of unfortunate purging of women of a certain age in popular music over the last, 15, 20 years.
Right. Well, it is, I guess, kind of the decline of adult contemporary MOR, right. I guess, which I think is a great thing. but yeah, Stefan for me has always been in that realm of what she's doing doesn't really have anything to do with my taste, but it works, you know?
Well, it was inescapable for a while.
Yeah, but, she's just kind of like an average singer. You know, there was some lightweight, agreeable dance pop and, with some Latin percussion thrown in. You know, they kind of sound like the best wedding band in Miami and
absolutely
to turn it into a good, especially on this song.
I think they also had the good fortune to come along when congas sounded like the most exotic thing in the world to top 40 radio programmer. I mean, this was the era of Jumbo Jumbo, right?
Yeah, a couple of years after it, yeah. But that was more Caribbean,
right?
But you know, I don't think anybody differentiated. This was also the era when, in soft jazz, every second record had a track on it with a song title like, I don't know, what's a good example? Does anybody have a Bob James CD they can grab?
Thankfully, no.
Cool Fiesta.
Cool Fiesta. Or something like, some made-up exotic-sounding word like Kajira or stuff like that. Everybody...
Right, because like Mahavishnu John McLaughlin sounded too Eastern. So they had to make it a little bit Latino.
I had a drum machine.
Yeah. And just like some thumbing, some Larry Graham's bad Larry Graham impression on the bass.
Yeah, conga's like that. It's like the AC outgrowth of that.
Right.
Outgrowth. Sounds painful.
Yeah. It was.
So, was this like the start of like the Latin explosion, I guess? I mean, which Gloria Estefan, to me, was like the first major Latino or Latina pop star.
Eldebarge
is biracial. He's not a...
Well, of the 70s and 80s, I mean, you could think back to all the...
Pablo Cruz!
You think back to like the Mambo era and Perez Prado, the more authentic Cuban stuff, Tito Puentes,
right,
and so on.
I don't even think you need to add the more part.
I mean,
of the authentic.
But
you just say authentic.
Yeah.
You know what was between like Jose Feliciano and Gloria Estefan?
Evolution.
Pablo Cruz. Rupert Holmes.
Oh God.
Yeah, I can hear it. There wasn't too much, like every once in a while you'd have like a, like some Latin percussion on a song somewhere, but not really any Latin stars or anything like that.
Right.
I really think it was the advent of the drum machine. You know, it made it easier to add a little third world spice to your song without having to pay a union conga player scale.
Do they have union conga players?
Paulinho da Costa.
Paulinho da Costa, that's right. As soon as that came out of my mouth, I was like, ah, shit.
Poor Paulinho da Costa.
I don't think he's poor.
He's a
triple scale guy.
It's true. I hope not.
That would be the last word. I mean, he's on like every third record I own.
Yeah, same here. He should own Belize at this point.
Right, exactly. Elected president of Cuba today.
Da Costa Rica.
Exactly.
We have to, we're mocking her heartily, and I think it's richly deserved. But we should give her props for, when the wind started to go out of her sails a little bit in terms of sales, she backed up. She started doing what she wanted to do instead of chasing that brass ring forever and doing state fairs indefinitely, you know, casinos. she could be Pat Benatar, but instead, I think she's kind of a mogul still.
She Very is. Much so, yeah.
I think she's responsible for John Cicada.
Yeah, I actually there's no justification for foisting that on us.
No. She doesn't deserve credit for that.
But one thing I will give her credit for, I was living in Florida during Hurricane Andrew, and she was everywhere during doing relief work and benefit concerts. And you know, this is right after she just had that bus accident, and was, you know, she had had a she was just trying to get her career restarted, and she basically, you know,
she was trying to walk.
Yeah, well, Coming Out of the Dark had been released like earlier that year, I think it was, and you know, she just stayed home, you know, and did a ton of work, and you know, I've got a lot of respect for her as a person, I think, yep. And yeah, she did that, you know, like I said, she just kind of like walked away and went more behind the scenes, and you know, I know that Emilio does a lot of writing and production. She never oversang or try to be something that she wasn't, you know, she wasn't like dressing like Madonna or anything like that, you know.
God bless her for not oversinging.
Yeah. You know, there was always a sense of, you know, that she was aware of her own limitations. And I think that definitely made her stuff, you know, not the best of that era, certainly, you know, still fairly listenable today.
Yeah. I think that's about as good as we're going to get for Gloria. I don't think anybody can say anything kinder about that, about her than that.
Number 9, Starship Sarah.
Fuck.
I like that song. I'm just going to go on the record right now and say that I actually like that song.
The only good thing about Starship is the story about the drummer breaking Mickey Thomas's face. Everything else about Starship sucks.
What's the story?
Who was drumming for them at the time, Dave? You probably know the details better than I do. Was
Ainsley
Dunbar?
Maybe. I saw his name listed on there. I never gave a shit about Starship or...
Right. Wikipedia is helping a brother out right now. So, the revamped lineup released Love Among Cannibals in August 1989 and went on another tour to support the album. On September 24th, 1989, while the band was in Scranton, Pennsylvania for a show, Donnie Baldwin and Mickey Thomas got into a bar fight, which resulted in Baldwin beating Thomas so badly that Thomas needed facial reconstructive surgery.
Yes.
There you go.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, you try playing Sarah every night. See what it does to you. It'll break a man.
Yeah. Holy crap.
Of all the bands that sold out and compromised their principles for the sake of a few top 40 hits in the 80s, I'm not sure any copped out more than Starship.
Yeah, because of like where they came from.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have to figure that Jack Cassidy and Jorma Kankinen are thrilled that they are in no way associated. And I had also looked on Wikipedia before this to find out, like, the history, and it said that Kantner was the one who made sure that, like, neither Jefferson nor Airplane would be involved in any of those things. So, you know, Paul Kantner is a bit of a dick. I didn't meet him. I met Cassidy. Kantner was being a dick when my friends opened up for a revamped Jefferson Starship a number of years ago. He was at least smart enough to know that what was coming, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to go from... Like, it's one thing to look at a band like Heart that compromised their principles to the extent that they were wearing corsets or whatever.
Right.
But to go from being an anti-establishment act to singing We Built This City...
Right.
Is just fucking unconscionable.
When I think of like number one songs from the 80s, I think of the ones that really define it, you know, like the Prince or Michael Jackson or whatever. And, you know, We Built the City, sadly, is one of those that also kind of defines it. But, I mean, this was 1 week, but this is so fucking forgettable. And you got to figure that a lot of cocaine was involved in getting this on the radio.
A few songs from this week's chart went to number one that kind of surprised me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this was the second number one hit from a terrible record. And fuck the starship.
I will go on the record as saying I would recognize probably more Starship songs than I would recognize Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship songs put together.
I would too, and that's to my everlasting detriment. I mean,
see, I knew that Nothing Was Going to Stop Us Now and We Built the City Were Starship. I didn't know. I knew this song, but I didn't remember that this was Starship.
Apparently, Rebecca De Mornay was in the video for Sarah.
Yeah.
Did not know that. I don't even know if I've ever watched the video for this song.
There's a windmill in it, I think. there's a barn and there's a... is there a tornado, I think?
I started to watch it when doing the notes for this, and then I just kind of like went from YouTube over to my...
You forgot what you were doing.
No, I went to start typing the notes. And
the next thing you knew, the video was over. That's the That's the appeal of this type of music.
Right.
I'm assuming by windmill you're not talking about breakdancing?
No.
Damn it.
It takes place on a farm.
Uh-huh.
And I think, if I remember right, the storyline is that a tornado came and destroyed Mickey Thomas's farm, but somehow left him unscathed.
He was busy shipping Rebecca De Mornay at her place.
She probably was. Fucking Mickey Thomas.
Fuck Mickey Thomas, fuck Starship, and fuck Matt Wardlaw.
That work, regardless of whose podcast it goes in, it works.
Yes, anytime there's a shitty AOR reference, we have to say, fuck Matt Wardlaw.
Matt Wardlaw has been shaking his head and crying AOR tears the whole time we've been dissing Starship here. You give me the sweetest taboo. You give me the sweetest.
A little bit of class here. The Sweetest Taboo by Sade.
Yeah.
Timeless.
Yes. Is this the first ever reference to Quiet Storm?
In a chart attack?
No, in general. The first time like it was used as a lyric. You know, like you always say...
No, Smokey Robinson invented that shit.
Yeah. Oh, he had an album called Quiet Storm. That's what started the format.
Oh, okay. Before he invented Frozen Jambalaya, he invented Quiet Storm.
Wait, what?
Oh, yes, my friend.
Yeah.
Smokey Robinson has a food line?
Yeah, he has a frozen food line.
Frozen food line.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, it goes next to the Linda McCartney frozen quinoa in your finer grocery stores.
Oh, shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
His face is on the box, too.
Wow.
Just to see her, he would thaw jambalaya.
Well, I guess somebody's got to pay that plastic surgeon.
Well, so Smokey invented Quiet Storm, but these guys took it to a whole new level.
Yeah.
I think the CDs replicated themselves because this is such powerfully effective baby-making music.
Right. I love how, at this very moment that R&B was changing towards the bombastic, you know, which we'll soon get to, here's this really cool, seductive voice that's just like in your ear. You know, I don't know if this is as good as Smooth Operator, but damn, is it good.
Well, I think, at the same time that there was this sort of dramatic soul music, which, I mean, it is what it is, and we can discuss that when we discuss that. But there was also Luther Vandross and Anita Baker. And,
right.
I mean, there was definitely an element of sort of jazzy, quieter, more sort of nuanced music on the radio as well.
Right, but Luther had been around for a while. You know, he didn't cross over to a mainstream audience until here and
89.
Now. Yeah.
Right.
And when did Rapture come out?
86.
Yeah. So this is kind of like the same time, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say in terms of reaching a pop audience, Sade probably kicked that off a little bit. But Anita Baker was right behind.
There's a list that I've been working on for years and years at Pop Dose of artists that we never want to change. And this band is definitely
on that
list.
Wasn't that the thing when they came out with that album? Was it in 2011? Was it?
2010.
Was it 10 or 11?
Yeah.
It was 2 or 3 years ago.
Relatively recently. In Sade years, yeah.
Yeah. And it just... sounded exactly like it did 25 years ago.
And everybody was thrilled.
Yeah. I mean, the changes that they make from album to album are very, very subtle. They are, I mean, if you listen to their first album and their most recent work, there's enough of a change to mix it up, make it sound different. But it's nothing contemporary, it's nothing jarring, it's nothing, you know, it's like a little bit of a fine tuning.
They're the R&B Steely Dan.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. You can get high to Steely Dan, you can get high to Sade.
But you can't fuck to Steely Dan.
That's true. That is true.
No, but I mean, if you were going to have sex to Steely Dan, it would be with your ex-wife that you hate, or your underage cousin, or something like that. You know? That's the only...
I mean, and I would say in addition to Sade more or less sounding the same over the course of the past 25 years, Sade Adu, the lead singer, looks exactly the same as she did 25 years ago.
Act with Satan.
I don't know what it is. I actually saw them live, and I saw them in concert last year. Maybe it was the year before, but excellent show.
I remember her at Live Aid, and just like wearing that tight backless outfit, and just like going, "Oh my god!"
She's gorgeous, despite having the biggest forehead in pop music history.
I've never noticed her forehead.
Really?
Well, it's also because her hair is always pulled back. No, the biggest forehead in pop music history is Merle Haggard.
I don't know what Merle Haggard's forehead looks like.
I think we're working on a list here.
That's a five head.
He's always wearing a hat.
You can sell advertising space on that.
Dwight Yoakam.
Same thing. Yep. Yeah. Number 7, Living in America by James Brown. Son of a bitch.
Why do you hate this song, dude?
Because this is James Brown's My Ding-a-Ling.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
It kind of is. I mean, it isn't as crass and pandering as... But no, it is. It's pretty pandering.
It is. Oh,
not as
on.
Crass.
It isn't as crass, there. But it's definitely pandering.
It's pandering. It has none of the raw energy of his great stuff, and for so many people of our age, this was our introduction to him.
Yes,
you know, I was thinking about that. I think we'd all probably heard "I Feel Good."
Yeah, we knew that. Maybe Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, but you know, yeah. And I knew that he was really, really influential to R&B and funk. You know, but I didn't really know much more about him than those two. But, you know, this is like someone walked into the session for one night in Bangkok and decided to do a James Brown impression.
Damn you, Dan Hartman. May you rest in peace, though.
He wrote this?
I'm pretty sure he wrote and produced it.
Oh, fucking hell.
At least it has horns.
Real horns.
Yeah. I don't know if it has real drums, but it's got real horns.
And here's something that just really made me sad. I looked this up on Wikipedia.
Apollo Creed died after it was played for the first time?
No, worse. Oh. The song was covered by the G.E. Smith Band as the finale of the 2012 Republican National Convention directly following Romney's speech.
Well,
this is like Don King's theme song, and that's like every reason to hate it.
It isn't much of a song.
I do stand corrected. Dan Hartman co-wrote the song, but he did not produce it.
Co-wrote it with who?
Charlie Midnight. Does anybody know who that is?
Charlie Midnight.
Charlie Midnight!
Is any relation to Johnny Lightfoot?
No.
That's Air Supply's bass player, for those of you who haven't been following along. For
those of you who are not Jason
Harris. And that's like that part of my brain that could cure cancer is being taken up with the knowledge that Johnny Lightfoot is Air Supply's bassist.
I just realized that this song was nominated for a Grammy.
It won a Grammy.
It was.
Oh my god, really?
Best male R&B vocal performance of 1986.
See, like I said, it's my ding-a-ling.
Charlie Midnight worked on the Bodyguard soundtrack.
Oh, God. Actually, wait, that's James Brown's only Grammy Award.
I give up.
It's the saddest thing I've heard in a long time.
Yes. And the worst thing is, you know that because this was like such a huge hit, he played it at every show after this until he died.
Yeah, yep. Probably.
Here's a list of artists that Charlie Midnight worked with. James Brown, Joe Cocker, Joni Mitchell, and Hilary Duff.
The law of diminishing returns right there.
Yes. I guess it was a Hilary Duff cut on a Marlo Thomas record.
Huh?
What's it, Free to Be You and Me, the sequel?
Thanks and Giving All Year Long.
Like I said, Free to Be You and Me, the sequel.
And this song is called... This is awesome. The song is called I'll Give Anything But Up.
Oh, that silence was poetic.
I think I just heard Dave snap.
I did the face palm.
He also worked with George Thorogood, apparently.
Oh, of course he did.
What a career.
Not bad, Charlie Midnight. But I will say that I have a slightly soft spot for Living in America just because of the fact that it was the theme to Rocky IV. Rocky IV,
Rocky
V. Rocky.
Rocky IV.
Your favorite Rocky?
My favorite Rocky.
Why?
Because it had Ivan Drago in it, man.
It had Ivan Drago, and I was 11 when it came out.
I never saw it, actually, because...
What?
Because I loved the first three so much, and by this time...
It's better than the third one.
Okay, but at the same time, I, like, what, 86? This I was 16.
60 what?
Shut up. I was almost 17. And I was like,
collecting unemployment.
Social Security.
Social Security.
I couldn't take it because it had all that music in it. All that lousy music in it. No, I was like so anti-jingoism. And I could just see that, you know, coming through on the commercials.
Yes.
And I just didn't want any part of it.
Dave, if you were anti-jingoism, this was a hard time for you, brother.
Oh, yeah.
I was 9. I didn't know what jingoism was.
Exactly.
I was really just starting that. I'm much worse on it now. But it was just kind of like, you know, when you're, you know, in your mid-teens is when your political awakening really first starts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd always kind of been, when you really start to have your, formulate your beliefs that'll carry you for much of your life unless you change at some point.
Well, I liked it because this was the Rocky where he had to go off into a cabin in the Siberian woods and grow a beard and chop wood. That was part of his training.
Right. I remember that. And was it Brigitte Nielsen in that one?
Yep.
She was Drago's wife?
Or something.
Trainer or some shit?
Yeah. Female clone? Yeah, I don't know.
And then she went off to fuck Mark Gastineau.
That's right.
Well, didn't she also fuck Sylvester Stallone for a while?
I think so, yeah. I think they weren't they married for a minute?
I think so.
And then her crowning achievement, Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Right.
This whole discussion.
I thought her crowning achievement was Flavor Flav.
Oh. You start with Living in America, end up at Flavor Flav.
Yeah, boy!
Well, there is a connection there. I mean, you got to figure Flavor Flav knows every James Brown track.
I would imagine crack has erased much of his memory of James Brown songs.
James Brown could be Flavor Flav's dad.
Oh, God.
Read the book.
Number 6, I'm Your Man by Wham. How ironic that the first Chart Attack without Jason has a Wham song. I think this was Chris Holmes' little joke.
That is pretty ironic.
Yeah. You know, I kind of miss the days when the pop charts had songs that tried to sound like Motown. You know, you either had you almost always at some point, you know, in some year had a song that was either a Motown cover or something that was trying to you know, call back to it in some way.
That is a brilliant point.
You know, and I just think it's sad that we have that Wham have a track that sounds more like a classic soul song than the James Brown song we just talked about.
You are absolutely right. I didn't think there was anything to say about this song, but that's right. I mean, yeah, this was this the same year or the year after that atrocious Dancing in the Streets cover?
Well, that was, a year that, was 80, that was 85 because that was for Live Aid.
Live Aid, yeah.
Yeah. And I think 86 was the year of the California Raisins, right?
Was it?
Probably.
I think so.
Yeah.
And it was definitely the year that Bruce Willis, or no, the year before Bruce Willis covered
Respect Yourself.
But, you know, and you had Phil Collins doing You Can't Hurry Love. You know, Motown's influence was so huge that 20 years later, 20 years after and, you know, of course, All Night Long was on Motown. You know, it didn't sound, you know, it was still on that label, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Motown was still a viable entity in 1986.
Right, until they just kind of, like, folded it into
MCA.
MCA, and, you know, they just said, okay, let's have everything. You know, our entire R&B roster will be called Motown.
Right.
And then, I guess, Def Jam took that over, right?
Yeah, there have been a few takeovers. I don't even know who owns it now. I think some Universal division owns Motown. But in the mid-80s, Motown, I mean, they still had, I mean, obviously besides Lionel Richie, they had, who the hell else did they have? They had Stevie Wonder and Smokey and Rick James and DeBarge and, you know, they weren't, it wasn't 1966, but they were still pretty viable.
Right, and then a few years later, they would have Boyz II Men.
Yes. Boyz II Men kept the lights on in that place for a long time.
Yeah.
But all that to say, yeah, I don't really have anything to say about this song either.
It's not much of a song.
No, it's a decent little pop song. It's not nearly as good as Careless Whisper or even as singable as Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, but, you know, it works.
I prefer Freedom.
It's in the lower echelon of Wham songs.
that's a dire place to be.
Yeah. You know, even some of the songs with George Michael raps are better than this. Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for. For good times and bad times, I'll be on your side forevermore.
Okay, number five. That's What Friends Are For by Dion and Friends. Jeff, do you want to talk about what happened at dinner tonight?
I don't want to talk about anything to do with this song. This is one of my least favorite songs of all time.
I'm with you.
I hate this song so much. I wish I could put this song and Friends and Lovers and what's the one that Patti LaBelle did with Michael McDonald?
On my own.
I'd like to put them all in a Viking boat. Set it on fire, and then just watch it sail into the distance. This song is so schmaltzy,
beyond schmaltzy.
I hope Carol Bayer Sager rots in hell.
Yeah, I didn't realize until tonight though that Rod Stewart recorded the first version of this.
He did.
Yeah, the story was that it was done for the movie Night Shift. Yeah. Which was Michael Keaton and Shelley Long. I think it was Ron Howard's directorial debut.
Henry Winkler wasn't in that.
I thought he was in that movie. Yeah.
Okay. Isn't that the one where
they form a prostitution ring out of a morgue?
Yeah, out of the morgue. There you go.
Yeah, and this was used over the closing credits. And apparently she was in a hotel and fell asleep with the television on. Hi Billy Joel. Hi Ted. woke up as this was playing and recognized it immediately as a Burt Bacharach song because those chords are so distinctly him. And, you know, that kind of got her to think, well, you know, maybe it's time to bury the hatchet between us. and it annoys me. Again, the part of my brain that could be used to cure cancer knows the story of that's what friends are for. But, you know, you do have to at least acknowledge that it raised a lot of money for AmFAR. And
at a time when not a lot of people were getting out in front on that issue, particularly in the R&B community, I would have to say.
Right. And as awful as the song is, you got to give credit to the performances.
They're very smooth.
That harmonica, you know, anytime I hear Stevie Wonder play the harmonica, it just works for me. It's such a distinctive tone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. This was back, wasn't Elton John still married at this point?
I think so. To a woman, for anybody who needs clarification there.
Married to a woman, yeah.
Yes.
I think this is back when kids our age didn't realize what was going on with Elton and George Michael and, God, maybe even Rock Hudson at that point.
See,
right?
I mean, well, Rock Hudson was dead by this point. Rock
was
Hudson,
he?
Yeah, he died in 85.
I thought it was 86.
Yeah, I mean,
we didn't know about Freddie Mercury, but we knew.
Or Liberace.
Yes.
I mean, I definitely didn't realize Elton John was gay, but, I mean, the George Michael is gay rumors were around, I mean, from as far back as I can remember my peers knowing who George Michael was.
I didn't know that. It wasn't like a rumor with George Michael. It was just more like, he's gay.
You know? And that was just because all the girls wanted George Michael.
Right,
and
okay. Because
he had the right ear earring, which at the time was, and the hair and the Choose Life shirts. Come on.
The impeccable stubble.
Yes.
Yes.
I think the gay rumor started with the shorts, the short shorts, and the Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go video.
Yeah.
I mean, in retrospect, how did we not know? But yeah, I think it's kind of funny that Elton was still somewhat, he had a couple of toes left in the closet at that point.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the song was for a great cause, a cause that not a lot of people were getting in front of, but that doesn't excuse the fact that it's a horrible song. Not as horrible as We Are the World, mind you.
Right.
But still fairly horrible.
Yeah. And as long as we're talking about Burt Bacharach, we should also say, hi, John Cummings. For once, we're in agreement here.
I didn't even think to compare this to We Are the World.
I mean, charity songs, I guess.
Yeah.
With multiple... Actually... All of them. Oh no, Gladys Knight wasn't on We Are the World. Half of the lineup was on We Are the World.
Right, and was Elton on? Do They Know It's Christmas?
I don't think so.
At that point, I don't think Elton knew it was Christmas. Or maybe every day was Christmas for Elton at that point.
There's a lot of snow.
A lot of snow, exactly.
But was this song? But as bad as this is, was this bad as bad as Hearing Aid?
I don't think I've ever listened to Hearing Aid.
Nor have I.
I remember hearing it once.
Better or worse than Sun City?
Sun City's vaguely charming.
It's close to home for Dave Lifton. I also wonder if this song would be improved by the presence of a screaming Cyndi Lauper, now that we're talking about We Are the World.
Hell yeah. Can you imagine?
Exactly.
Then, like, record the session and the four of them, well, Stevie, not Stevie because he can't see shit, but everybody else is just sort of like... staring at Cyndi in horror as she screams.
After Bob Dylan makes Al Jarreau cry.
Nice try.
Yeah.
Right after Bob Dylan, like, wheezes through his portion.
Keep smiling. Keep shining. Knowing you can always count on me.
Yeah, exactly.
At the sessions, Al Jarreau was so excited to meet Bob Dylan that he broke down in tears.
Are you serious?
Bob, like, wouldn't even talk to him.
Wow.
It might be apocryphal. That's a story that I've heard.
Number 4. Kyrie by Mr. Mister. Yeah.
Do you hate this song, Mike? I can't. I don't really have anything bad to say about it.
I strongly dislike that song. I don't know why. Maybe whenever I think of that song, this is so random. I think of Marilyn McCoo singing it on Solid Gold.
Whoa. That happened?
It did. It did.
Why?
I don't know. It was one of the top 10 songs, and Marilyn McCoo just decided that she was going to sing it.
That sounds like something less than a good time.
It probably was, and it might not have been Marilyn McCoo. It might have been Dionne Warwick. I don't know who was hosting the show at that time. Bringing it full
Stevie
circle.
Melton.
Right.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't think of Mr. Mister singing it. I think of either Dionne Warwick or Marilyn McCoo singing it, whichever.
I liked it better than Broken Wings.
Oh no, I love Broken Wings.
I like Broken Wings now. I didn't like it at the time. I like this song better because it had a bit of a pulse and some melodic melodrama going on. I didn't realize until much later that it was a religious prayer.
Yes.
See, I knew that it was then.
That's because you were an altar boy.
That's because you were 60.
I could tell you how I knew what it was, but it would be kind of like a roundabout way. But when this... you know, came out, I was already moving away from top 40 and listening to a lot of classic rock and playing guitar. I was like really, really anti-synth. And, you know, like now I listen to a lot of the songs from that era and I judge them more as songs and, yeah, this still sucks.
What's funny about these guys, though, is that they were great musicians. The Pat, how do you say his last name?
Huh?
The drummer in Mr. Mister.
I don't know who the drummer and Mr. was.
Pat Mastellato.
Okay, sure, why not? He's not going to listen.
What else is he doing?
Dude was in King Crimson.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There were some good musicians in this band. They didn't show it on that first record, necessarily, but I'm not sure anybody on the top 40 was showing it.
Wow. Pat Mastellato has worked with XTC, Hall & Oates, The Rembrandts, Jude Cole, Eddie Money, Matthew Sweet, Robin Hitchcock, Julia Fordham. Nice lineup.
These guys, I think, rather smartly adapted themselves to the constraints of the day. And I think once they got a toehold, they tried to get a little smarter and a little more organic with their follow-up record, and it went nowhere. And then they were dropped in the middle of, actually probably not even in the middle of, I think it was done, recording their last record. And then they just kind of scattered, and I think they all went on to studio session musician careers.
Huh.
None of which you would guess by listening to this.
As I hold my copy of Mr. Mister's Greatest Hits in my hand.
It's a very light CD.
You disappoint me.
It's 10 songs.
it's a 3-inch single.
Mr. Broken Wings, backed with Kyrie. Did they have any other hits besides these two?
It's a minor hit.
Yeah, Is It Love? That was a top 10
Is It Love? And then on the second record, there was, what is it called? Something Real, Inside Me, Inside You.
Yes.
The most Jason Hare song of all Jason Hare songs because it has parentheses and a slash.
Yes. Yes, it does.
All the needless 80s punctuation you can handle in one song title.
Awesome.
No, they their records aren't very good, but they were a talented band.
Yeah, but it suffers from that 80s disease that's around, still around today, where there's like no space and everything sounds like it was recorded in a different county, you know?
And it sounds like a song that you could not write on an acoustic guitar.
Right. Yeah. And also one where the chorus came first, because it's who the hell knows the verses to this song? But
yeah, right.
But the way that it, you know, the chorus rises up to the melody, and it's so much more memorable. It's, you know, you could hear that in so many songs from the 80s, where you just know that they came up with that first.
I'm just waiting for a hip-hop artist to cover it.
Oh, that's not going to happen.
Sample it.
I mean, Broken Wings has been sampled, but I don't know if anybody's going to sample Kyrie.
Drake will do it someday.
I still hate that song.
Yeah, it fuck Mr. Mister.
Fuck Mr. Mister.
We're really going out on a limb with that one, aren't we?
Right.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it doesn't really take much balls to say fuck Mr. Mister.
You never know.
We're destroying some sacred fucking cows here.
Well,
one of those guys might live in Chicago, and he'll show up at your house.
Yep.
Those guys are all LA guys.
You start getting emails, him and Richard Marx.
Well, Jeff, you liked the song. You were the voice of dissent.
That's right.
Yeah.
Don't send me angry emails, Pat Mastellato.
Learn to say my name right.
I'm just shocked to learn that they had a drummer.
I know, right? I mean,
was he just like in the touring band or something?
No, he was. He was the band. He was in the band. He was, they would. They, I don't really remember the story behind them. I think they may have been a like a baby Toto.
Right.
A baby Toto.
I can definitely see that. And it says that Page was offered the chance to replace Bobby Kimball.
In Toto, yeah.
And was offered Cetera's place.
Yes, wow.
Yeah.
And what's he doing now? Not a goddamn thing, probably.
Richard Page?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. He's got to have a website.
You know who knows the answer?
Matt
our
Wardlaw?
Friend Matt Wardlaw.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody give him a call. We'll take a good 15 minutes off this podcast by explaining the whereabouts of Richard Page and what he's been doing for the past 25 years.
I think he put out a solo record a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Through his website.
I know he did the Ringo Starr tour.
Right.
Really?
And I know... Yeah,
he's done it twice.
In the mid-90s, he was on Blue Thumb for a minute.
Okay.
About as long as
Blue Thumb was
lasted.
Around.
Right.
Yeah. In the burning heart, just about to burst, there's a quest for answers and a creature of the best. In the darkest night, rising like a spire. In the burning heart, the unmistakable fire. In the burning heart.
Number 3, Burning Heart. Survivor.
Jingo!
More Rocky IV.
Jingo, it's you! You're back!
I must break you.
God damn, I hated Reagan's second term.
I did not realize until this week how... I didn't realize what was in the verses.
I've never looked at the lyrics of the song.
It is pretty lame.
You can't say that, Jeff, because this was co-written by your good buddy. Your new
I
best
know.
Friend.
It was co-written by my good buddy Jim Peterick. But, the, is there a soundtrack hit that more explicitly lays out the storyline of the movie than Burning Heart?
Mrs. Robinson? which wasn't actually in the movie apart from the chorus.
Right. You know do you know the verses that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I heard it when listening to this again. It's like, oh yeah, this is, you know. It was clearly written for the movie with the knowledge
exactly.
of what the movie was. Yeah.
Isn't that, what's the line? Is it East against West or Man against Man?
Right.
And then there's something about, it looks like our freedom's up against the wall.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Quite lame.
So basically it's like a Tea Party anthem.
Don't give him any ideas.
Yeah. And so once again, now that we have a Survivor song in here, we can all say it together. Fuck you.
Fuck Matt Wardlaw.
Wardlaw.
Poor man.
Don't disinvite me from your wedding.
But you know, yeah, it's like I listen to this and I just, you know, hope the Russians love their children too.
Oh.
You gotta give Survivor a little bit of credit for managing to score an up-tempo hit.
What the hell was I the Tiger?
Yeah, but then after that they had the Searches Over.
High on You, that was up-tempo.
High on You.
Mm-hmm. This is just a bad rewrite of Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
I agree with you. But you just, I mean, for a lot of bands, once you dip into that power ballad well,
right.
there's no turning back. Right.
Look at Foreigner, yeah.
But Burning Heart, you know, it's a rock song. I guess you could attribute its success completely to Rocky IV, but still. It's even less of a song than Living in America.
Oh, sure. You're like saying that like Richard Page is going to come to my apartment here in Chicago, and yet for make fun of, and yet there's a guy who fucking lives in Chicago who co-wrote the song, who's your good buddy now, and you know you're putting my life on the line here.
He has purple hair and a collection of vintage cars. I think you'll see him coming from a mile away. Well, I don't know what to say about this song.
Nor do I.
Survivor trucked on for another couple of years. I think their last big hit was 87.
Was that The Search Is Over?
No, The Search Is Over was 85.
I don't fucking know. All that shit runs into the same.
I always get High on You and Is This Love confused. I think Is This Love was the last.
I don't know that I've ever heard Is This Love.
Another Whitesnake song.
Yeah.
Did people buy that thinking they were buying the Whitesnake song?
Probably.
Wouldn't that be funny? Yeah. Now I want David Coverdale to front Survivor.
Number two, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Billy Ocean, another 8-word Billy Ocean title that goes to number one.
Why?
Wait, this song didn't go to number
Billy
one.
Is Billy Ocean popular?
I don't know. I like Billy Ocean. I don't like that song. I mean, I think that song is very perfect for the number two position.
yeah, exactly. It's a total number two.
But I got nothing. I got no qualms with Billy Ocean.
Oof.
No, you didn't know. You don't know the 8-word Billy Ocean thing.
Oh,
Mike,
I do.
No, I know you do. But Mike was surprised that it had gone to number one.
I don't think it did go to number one.
All of Billy Ocean's songs that have 8 words in the title. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car, and Caribbean Queen, 2 Hearts Beat as 1.
Hang on, I'm going to call shenanigans on this one. Hang on.
Those are his only number one songs. Suddenly went to number four, I think it was.
It reached number two on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles Chart. Bam, disproven.
Fuck you, Billboard.
Listen, that's embarrassing, but... Look at it this way, Dave. We're deducting a number one hit. There's a net win here.
Maybe his 3 biggest hits had 8 words in the title.
He was terrible.
He was not terrible.
He was average.
He was an R&B reverse Samson because when he grew out his hair, he lost all of his power. Remember his silly little dreadlocks?
Well, now he has really unsilly, like long-ass dreadlocks. And they're white. Like he looks like a wizard nowadays.
Some dude from the Matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
He should be wearing contacts and a trench coat. I don't know. I really, really hated everything that he ever did. I could not stand Caribbean Queen.
What?
It was a little. The whistling was a little gimmicky.
I thought the whole thing was gimmicky.
Well, yeah, but I mean that was like you know the wah-wah pedal in the Joker. It was the exact same thing, you know? But I'm surprised that you don't like this because, you know, this has one of your favorite things in 80s videos.
Oh, with the stars from the movie?
Yeah.
Pretend to be in the band? Oh, God, I know.
Yeah.
I remember
and
that
apparently somebody thought it would be funny to have Danny DeVito play a baritone sax because it's almost
yeah,
as big as he is.
As tall as he is, yeah. Yeah. This was, Who's Johnny was 86 also.
Yes, sir.
Oh, fuck. And also, Love Touch was also 86.
Yep.
Oh,
fuck Love Touch.
This is the holy trinity of shitty soundtrack videos because Who's Johnny has the best soundtrack video moment.
Which is?
Which is the Gutenberg cutout.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Yeah, they couldn't get Gut in the video, so they... They used a cutout. And then, if I remember right, and there's no way in hell I'm ever going to watch it again to make sure, but if I remember right, I think the Love Touch video used clips from the movie to make it look like Redford and... Who was it?
Deborah Winger, I believe, yeah.
Like they were in the video with him when they weren't. Is that right?
I don't remember the Love Touch video at all. Wait, wasn't he
in a
courtroom? Damn it!
Yeah. Yeah, and I think they made it look like Robert Redford and Deborah Winger were his lawyers. I think he was singing to the judge, like Billy Joel in Keeping the Faith.
But at least it's got Kathleen Turner in it, and she was so hot back then.
She was great. Yeah, she was great. But this song is not.
No.
It is not great.
It's better than Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into
I think
My
it's
car.
Better
I agree.
Than Get Out of My Dreams and Caribbean Queen.
It's not better than Caribbean Queen.
Yes.
It is not.
Why do you like Caribbean Queen?
Because it's a good song.
I can't talk to you when you're like this, Mike.
It is a good song. If Jason was here, he would agree with me.
That's probably true.
And that's just every bit as reason to not like it.
Billy Ocean is actually from the Caribbean.
Yes, right. He is.
Because I know it's unfair of me, but I lump this in with all the other cheesy, fake, exotic top 40 stuff.
Jamba Jamba.
Era. Jamba Jamba,
nah.
Exactly.
He wasn't exotic.
Caribbean Queen, though. Listen to there's the title.
The title. That was the only thing that was exotic about it.
No more love on the run. And I also didn't like There'll Be Sad Songs to Make You.
Oh, cry. I love that song.
Oh, Mike, you have an inexplicable fondness for for Billy Ocean.
How is it? It's not. Are there plenty of people who love Billy Ocean?
Look at who Mike is. I don't think it's inexplicable at all.
Mike has excellent taste. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's because I'm black, right?
Well, it...
I think that's what he was saying.
It's because
he
you're black,
look at you.
Came of age in the 80s, and have a fondness for, you know, like you were so influenced by 80s R&B, is what I'm saying. That it's not wrong for you to, you know, have a fondness for these songs.
I submit that there is very little that is either R or B about Billy Ocean's music.
It was rhythmic.
It does have the same rhythm as Caribbean Cream does have the same rhythm as Billie Jean.
It does.
Dun, 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 dun.
God damn it. Did Billy Ocean have a band?
No.
Yeah, this was all out of a can, right?
This song in particular, I think, was pretty much...
It had to be. It had to be all session guys.
Well, but even like the rhythm tracks, I mean, they were not live. I think
that song is pretty much all synthesized.
Yeah, except for the horns.
Was he on Arista?
Jive.
Okay.
Along with... wasn't Samantha Fox on Jive?
She was. It was Samantha Fox, Billy Ocean, and a bunch of rappers.
Yeah, I think 1992 was the year that Billy Ocean and Samantha Fox both put out Greatest Hits records.
I may or may not own both of those.
Hits.
Samantha Fox had hits.
She had a couple.
She had a few.
She had two, really.
Three.
She was much more popular on Dorm Walls than she was on
the
CD.
True. I think she did have three, though, because she had Touch Me, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty
And then
fun.
She had Naughty Girls. And there was another one, too.
Yeah, I Want to Have Some Fun.
I Want to Have Some Fun. Yeah. There you go. Three big hits. And
yeah, two big hits.
Two ginormous.
Yeah. No, because I was in college at that time when that hit, and like it was like all over the place. And you know, if you had a if you had like a picture of Samantha Fox on top of a Camaro, that was a guarantee that you were never going to get either of those two things.
Next to a picture of Tawny Katane.
Yeah.
I'm sure Billy Ocean has put out a few greatest hits of his own on Ocean Recordings.
Well, yeah, because he had all those songs before he became famous.
Did
he? He had been recording since the mid-70s.
Mid-70s, yeah.
Look, under labels, it says GTO, Epic, Jive, and Aqua Music. I was not far off when I said Billy Ocean Recordings.
What's Aqua Music?
There's water. Ocean.
Oh!
I'm sure Billy Ocean owns it.
Well, I'll be.
He wanted to be egotistical, but not too egotistical.
Greatest Hits, released in 1989, and apparently went platinum in the United States. What the fuck?
Wow. Hey, you know, if you're going to buy a Billy Ocean album, you're going to buy a Greatest Hits record.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the cover of his Greatest Hits now. It looks like it was taken at Olin Mills.
I'm not sure what that means.
Olin Mills was the... it was like the standalone equivalent of the photo studio at a JCPenney's or a Sears.
Okay.
Where you go and stand in front of a cheesy, you know, painted backdrop.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the cover of Billy Ocean's Greatest Hits right there.
Number one, How Will I Know by Whitney Houston.
Oh, Whitney.
Yeah, and actually this is going live the week of the first anniversary of her death.
Yes, it is. It is.
February 12th.
I was just talking with David Wilde on Twitter about the grossness of that stupid special that CBS is airing about how her death affected the Grammys last year.
To try to hype... this year's Grammys?
I guess. I don't care what the reason is. I mean, there's no reason to take that kind of angle when you're talking about somebody dying.
Right.
Who gives a shit?
Right. Yeah.
Even if she combusted and blew up at the Grammys and killed three people, you still don't need to make a documentary about how her death affected the Grammys.
Well, I mean, the sad thing is, I guess not the sad thing, but sort of the expected thing is, I don't know what the name of the guy who produces the Grammy Awards is. Ken Ehrlich, I guess. He wrote the book about the Grammy Awards, and, like, he just seems like a kind of a pompous dick. so if you stick him in a blender with, like, Clive Davis and, you know, I assume Whitney's mother, you know, I mean, I think you have a group of people who are not terribly worried about pushing the boundaries of taste.
Yeah, Whitney's mother got a little bad press this week, huh? Didn't come off so well in that interview.
I know she has a book deal, or she has a book out.
No, she talked to Oprah.
Oh, did she?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay, I wasn't aware of that.
She spoke with Oprah and the subject of, what was the name of the woman that Whitney was supposedly involved with?
Robin Crawford.
Robin Crawford, that name came up, and Mrs. Houston made no bones of the fact that she did not approve of... She would not have approved if Whitney had opened up to her and, you know, and admitted that they were in that relationship and made no bones about the fact that she didn't care for that woman either.
Gotcha.
And Whitney's brother was there and shared the story of how he was the one who introduced Whitney to cocaine.
Lovely.
That I saw a headline about. I didn't know the rest of the story.
Sounded like a really depressing hour of television.
Well, won't be watching that.
This is not a bad song.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Whitney made many worse songs.
Oh, that's true. I didn't know, though, that this was presented first to Janet Jackson.
That is correct.
And she turned it down.
Turned it down.
And it was written by Boy Meets Girl.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. As was I Want to Dance with Somebody.
And then they presented her with Waiting for a Star to Fall, and she turned it down.
Well, that song was apparently written about her, if I remember this story correctly.
Well, now we're getting dark.
Hey, wait a minute. What's wrong with you people?
That's racist.
Ah, yes. The song was inspired by an actual falling star that Shannon Rubicam had seen at one of Whitney Houston's concerts.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't about Whitney getting high backstage.
No, it wasn't about Whitney getting high backstage. Right. And apparently Clive Davis rejected it, and Whitney herself did not. And apparently, I'm sorry, now we're talking about Waiting for a Star to Fall. The song was then offered to and recorded by Belinda Carlisle for her 1987 release Heaven on Earth. But Carlisle disliked the song, and she ultimately refused to include it on the album.
Waiting for a Goat to Sing. I don't want to imagine what it would have sounded like if Belinda Carlisle had hit with
Waiting for a Star to Fall. Sorry.
Also known as what now?
Also known as the Stevie Nicks story.
Right.
Oh, man. Yes.
But Boy Meets Girl was on RCA, weren't
they?
Yeah. It wasn't Arista under the same umbrella at the time?
It may have been.
Wasn't this all the same big, happy corporate
BMG,
family?
Yeah.
Yes,
I don't know like when all that stuff happened, but I know that when I was working in the 90s, Arista and RCA were all BMG.
So we already know about Whitney Houston's story. Right. It's the Boy Meets Girl story that's moderately more fascinating to me. I didn't realize that those guys stayed married until like the year 2000.
Hmm.
And they have a kid, and that kid was in the video.
Really?
For Waiting for a Star to Fall. Yeah.
Hmm.
They're like... new shoes.
Ashford and Simpson?
Ashford and Simpson, Boy Meets Girl, Will to Power, and New Shoes all should have toured together. Right.
With Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. as the opening act.
We're still married.
All of them opening for Buckingham Knicks.
All these wonderful happy marriages and opening up for a train wreck. I love it.
This is a perfectly pleasant little pop song.
It is.
It's funny, you know, this whole summer, you know, with Call Me Maybe being on the the charts, you know, there was that whole thing, well, you know, here's a woman in her mid-20s singing a teen pop song.
Right.
And, you know, Whitney wasn't, was she was, what, 22, 23 here?
Something like that, yeah.
Was she?
Yeah, and the song is every bit as adolescent, but, you know, she had had so much more of a life behind her by this point.
I thought she was younger. Wasn't this off of her first record?
Yeah.
Wasn't she still a teenager?
No. When that, I mean...
She was in her early 20s.
Yeah. I think when the album was released, she was 22.
Okay, I thought she was younger, because I thought when she was fucking around with Jermaine Jackson, she was underage, or close to it.
No, right? She was probably 20, 21.
All right. What do I know? Yeah. I don't know anything about Whitney Houston. I'm learning.
Yeah, but no, it's a great pure pop song, and but if you think about it, you know, she is a little, her voice is way too adult and mature to sing this. But you know, it works because
she probably would have sounded too mature for this when she was 12.
Right, exactly.
She,
you know,
incredible voice.
She was, I mean, she was singing with her mom as a teenager. Right. You know, which is also what Aretha was doing, singing with her dad.
Right. I'm trying to picture a teenage Janet Jackson's voice on that song.
I know, right? It would have been an embarrassment.
I can kind of picture it.
Can you?
Because, I mean, her first two albums were very sort of like in this vein.
Did she actually try to sing?
I mean, not like Whitney. Definitely not like Whitney. I mean, I don't know that song was meant to be belted, though. I think it was definitely meant initially to be more girlish.
There's a story on the... I think you're right. Because there's a story on the song's Wikipedia page about how... what's his name? Narada Michael Walden overhauled it. He changed it around. He didn't like the chord progression. He thought it was... I think, if I remember right, I think he thought it was boring. And he changed it to his liking. So maybe in its original incarnation, it would have been okay for Janet. But there's no way this arrangement ever would have... she wouldn't have been able to
no.
do it. The technology was not there.
Yeah.
What's funny is that this is one of the less, I think, one of the less substantial songs on the record, which is kind of reflective of how strong a record it is.
Yeah, this was one of the last singles that was released from it.
It was at least the third single.
It was the
yeah.
third.
Yeah, but it was interesting that how they kind of subverted the formula, because usually you'd go after the teen market first, and then build
right.
it as the AC. I guess that had to have been Clive Davis's understanding of where her talents really were to start with You Give Good Love and Saving All My Love for You, these kind of almost jazzy ballads.
Oh, they're like pop standards.
Yeah.
And you know who was watching is Tommy Mottola.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying that he took the same tack when Mariah came
yeah.
out. You know, Vision of Love... I think we've probably had this conversation before, but
I think that's her best song.
One of the last, if not the last, standard sounding pop songs.
Right.
I don't know. You know, I mean, early Whitney is sort of I run hot and cold on some of that stuff because some of it is just so sappy. I can't, you know, I can't deal. But I mean, How Will I Know is a great song. It's just fun.
When I think of young early Whitney and those fun. Sort of lightweight tracks. I always think of that video where she's like rolling around in paint.
Isn't that the How Will I Know video?
Is
that How Will I Know? I think it was a song from the second record. I want to dance with somebody who loves me.
It was one of those two. I mean, this was to me these two songs were interchangeable. It's funny because I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me was the lead single off of the second record
from Whitney. Yeah,
you know, so like thinking about like you know, so and it was clearly an attempt at a rewrite of How Will I Know. I think it's actually probably a more memorable song.
Well, written by the same people.
You know, did you all after she died, they discovered, it went through on YouTube, somebody had isolated just the vocal tracks from that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Flawless.
Yes.
Yep. Singing her ass
she
off.
She was no David Lee Roth. Well, Whitney Houston is still dead.
Yeah. Damn shame, because, you know, you look at... you know, one of the things, you know, like sometimes like I'll see a picture of like the young Elvis or the Beatles in 63 and you just look at them and you say there's no way on earth that they could fail. It was like
yeah.
the perfect look to go with the sound for their times and
right.
Michael had it in 69 and, you know, Whitney was in that category too. Not
oh,
just
absolutely.
Not just by being beautiful and extraordinarily talented, it, you know, the multicolored headband and, you know, like she just... had the exact
she was
look
perfect for the time.
Yeah.
like you say.
Yeah.
She had the world at her feet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow Courtney Love lives. Aruba,
and that's going to do it for this episode, our debut episode of Chart Attack. Jeff, Mike, thanks for being the guinea pigs today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, and follow us on Twitter at Popdos. Join our Facebook group. Download episodes of all of our other podcasts on iTunes. We have good stuff there. And we'll be back next month with two other people, and we'll be talking about a chart from an entirely different year. And we really have no idea what that's going to be yet. That's all up in Chris Holmes' crazy warped gray flannel mind of what we're gonna do. So we'll see you next month.
Keep smiling, keep shining.
You are listening to Pop Toes.
Can't somebody just call Shaka?
she's available.
Hello? Is this Shaka Khan? Shaka Khan.
Can you imagine if that's her ringtone?
Her outgoing message. I was going to say outgoing message, but it would be even better if that was her ringtone. So anyway, yeah, Mike, call Shaka Khan.
Me? Why do I have to call her?
You probably know somebody who's got her number.
Is that because I'm black?
No, you know what Shaka Khan's outgoing message is? Her voicemail message? Hi, this is Shaka. I'm not here. Tell me something good. Beep.
And you know what's fucked up? That probably is Shaka Khan's outgoing message.